month. One for Dan, one for the country.
And there has never been a more exciting time to be in Australia.
Dead, buried, cremated.
Australia's basically done for. We'll just end up being a third-rate economy. You know, a banana republic.
Just follow the money.
G'day and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast, demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm not Ebony Bennett, the Deputy Director at the Australia Institute, who has a really bad case of laryngitis, a podcaster's worst nightmare. I'm Jennifer Macy, the Australia Institute's podcast producer, filling in just for this special episode on unpacking the 2019 budget. Budget night is otherwise referred to at the Australia Institute as Economists' Christmas. And so a day later, let's say Economists' Boxing Day, an expert panel of economists got together for the Australia Institute's popular Politics in the Pub session. They include the Australia Institute's chief economist, Richard Dennis, senior economist, Matt Grudnoff, and joining them for the first time, Troy Henderson, an economist from the Australia Institute's Centre for Future Work. But before we kick off with Matt, a few highlights from Budget Night this election year.
Tonight, I announce that the budget is back in the black and Australia is back on track.
Yeah! I'm pleased that in the current year we've actually beat what I said the budget would be last year by $10 billion.
Well, if the opinion polls do play out, Josh Frydenberg's first budget will never become a reality, with Labor leader Bill Shorten on track to claim
victory. This government didn't deal with some of the key issues. It's a con to get you through the next 6 weeks.
This is not a budget that actually sets the country up for the future. There's no vision, there's no blueprint to take us into the 21st century.
I'm from Campbell High, I'm 15 years old.
I'm from Harrison School and I'm 14.
Someone needs to take action for our future, and it's become really obvious to us that none of the adults in Parliament who have any power are going to.
Well, it was an election budget, but one with a twist. But to begin with, you know, they say you should start with a joke. So three economists walk into a bar to talk about the budget, and hundreds of people show up. How Canberra is that? And the reason that excites me is because I get really excited at budget time. It is my favourite time of year. And usually my family and friends look at me perplexly. So it's nice to see other people who are actually interested in the budget. And the reason I think the budget is so exciting is because politicians basically talk nonsense most of the year round. But it's the one time of year when you get to actually find out what their real priorities are. They can tell you that this particular issue is really important or that project is really important, but if they don't put any money into it, you know that they're just telling you nonsense. But if they actually put money into it, you know, well, that's actually their priority. So budgets are about finding out politicians' priorities, or as the government's been continuously telling us, it's also about values. And the government's very keen to tell us that its values are lower taxes, but what they're less keen to talk to you about is that they want to maintain a surplus, so the only way you get lower taxes with a surplus is if you have less spending. And they're not so keen to talk to you about the fact that every time you hear Josh Frydenberg, the Treasurer, say, we believe in lower taxes, every time you hear the Prime Minister say, we like lower taxes, every time you hear any Liberal Party politician say, we like lower taxes, they're also telling you that they want less spending. They want less spending on health, they want less spending on education, they want less spending on aged care, they want less spending on all the sort of things that that people demand. You can't have a surplus budget, lower taxes and more spending. That's the magic pudding that just can't exist. So the budget was quite interesting. I've got just a couple of things I'll go through. I mean, the budget is a massive document and there's lots and lots of things in there. But probably the main thing they're talking about is the tax cuts. And basically, these tax cuts are a building on previous tax cuts that they announced last year. And really, they're a lot of light and movement about low and middle income tax offsets in the short term. And what they talk less about in the long term is a flattening of the tax scales. Now, flattening of the tax scales means less progressive taxation. if you flatten tax scales, if you put everybody or most people on one tax rate, then you're effectively reducing the progressive nature of the tax system. What does that mean? Well, progressive taxes is what's underpinned income tax since World War II. And it just means that the more you earn, the more income you have, the higher proportion of tax you pay. So as you flatten them out, what it simply means is that those on higher incomes pay less as a proportion of their tax, and those on low incomes will inevitably pay more. And while they're keen to give you something early on in the form of a tax offset, they're less keen to talk about those flattening of tax rates, which happens sort of 6-7 years' time. And we actually did an analysis of those tax cuts once they're fully implemented, and we found that a third of them go to the top 10% of income earners, more than half of them, 54%, go to the top 20% of income earners, and just 3% of those tax cuts go to the bottom 20% of income earners. So they really are targeted at high income earners. And not just high income earners, they're also targeted at men. We did a gender split for them, and we found that when they're fully implemented, for every dollar that women get in tax cuts, men will get $2. So for every dollar that females get in the tax cut, men will get $2 worth. And that's mainly because men predominantly dominate the high income area. So there's more men earning higher incomes. Also, the government has been talking a lot about fiscal rules, which is certainly words that bore everybody to death. But they've been talking about this thing they call the 23.9% cap on spending. And basically, it's designed to stop future governments from allowing tax revenue to grow and therefore be able to spend more money. What's fascinating about them is they're non-binding, so the Liberal Party spent a lot of time saying Labor should follow these rules that we've invented. But also, they actually had three rules, and they broke two of them in this budget. So even those rules, the government aren't keen to follow.
Do as I say, not as
yeah,
I do.
Yeah, yeah, so the rules I make are the rules I break. So it basically means that they're not particularly serious about this, and they're quite happy to break those rules. But I think I'll stop there, and I'll hand over to Richard.
Yeah, what did you think of the budget, Richard?
Well, I didn't go to lock-up. I was locked out this year, and it's a good thing. I actually think, by the way, before I talk about the budget, I want to talk about the process. In America, they have the State of the Union address as their big How's Our Nation Travelling annual speech. And in Australia, we have the State of Our Finances. We talk about our budget. And it's the one prime-time televised speech that a government makes, and it's not even made by the Prime Minister. So budgets are very important. As Matt said, budgets are one of the main ways in which a government can express its values and its priorities. Who gets more, who gets less? But the fact that that talking about our finances, and every journalist, nearly every journalist, falls into the trap of saying the nation's health or the nation's wealth. This is the Commonwealth government. It's the taxes that we pay. It's the money that they spend on us. But whether there's a budget deficit of $7 billion or a budget surplus of $7 billion, that's rounding error in the national economy. And to suggest that the health of our economy, the health of our society can be captured in that way is alarming. And Australia is one of the few countries in the world that has a budget lock-up. Have you ever thought about what the lock-up is all about? It's about locking senior journalists, not up, it's locking them away. They're literally locked in a room with only one story to write about all day long, the budget. And guess what happens when you lock hundreds of journalists in a room with no access to the outside world and only one story to write about? They write about it. So we talk endlessly about it for days, and we rightly, I think, dissect it. But the national media, there's no reason the budget couldn't be released at 10 o'clock in the morning. There's no reason that budget documents couldn't all go up online and we could all read them all day and journalists could call anyone they want and talk about it. But it's this staged, managed process. And I think we need to kind of reflect on why for so many years now we've let politicians tell us that the state of the budget is in some way the state of our country. Nothing could be further from the proof. In terms of the contents of the budget, well, you know, I agree with most of what Matt said. I just want to emphasise that, you know, let's be clear, Australia isn't living up to its international obligations on foreign aid. We are one of the richest countries in the world, living at the richest point in world history. We can afford tax cuts for high-income earners like me, and we can't afford to spend more on international aid and development. I don't know why you're clapping. I think now would be a time to boo or hiss. So what we have to look at in terms of $150 billion worth of tax cuts, how many years is that over, Matt? I can't remember. I think that's over 10.
10, yeah.
Yeah, right. So
it's $300 billion.
Yeah, so we've had $300 billion worth of tax cuts announced in the last 2 years. Well, let's remember that in 2013 we had a budget emergency. In 2013 we had a budget emergency and Tony Abbott said the number one thing we had to do was pay down debt. We've doubled the public debt. I am unconcerned about this, by the way, but we've doubled it. So if the crisis was the level of debt in 2013, the crisis is twice as big now. And then after announcing that we'll have one small budget surplus in the coming year, right, we haven't had a budget surplus yet, we're projecting one for this year, apparently doubling the debt is no longer a problem because we're going to have one surplus. So if that was a household, imagine you had $20,000 on your credit card in 2013, you've now got $40,000 on your credit card. Is that a problem? No, why not? Oh, I made my first repayment. I've started to pay some back, so everything's all right. Now, again, Australia is a low-tax, low-debt country. We never were in a budget emergency, but we were lied to in 2013. Sensible people were scared into thinking we had a problem, but the people that scared us into thinking we had a problem treated that problem with contempt, and now even though they've doubled the amount of debt that they were allegedly worried about, they've announced $300 billion worth of tax cuts. I call this the right-wing ratchet. Whenever times are good, cut taxes for your friends. Whenever times are bad, cut spending on your enemies. Okay, Australia is one of the richest countries in the world. We use tax cuts to create... We use tax cuts to cause budget deficits in the future because when the budget deficit comes along, it's a great excuse to cut spending on health, cut spending on education, you name it. So, a little bit of context. The budget is important, but we've kind of, in Australia, turned it into this enormous thing, but, you know, our media don't even go back and really give us 5 years of economic history to place everything you heard last night into context, which of course makes a mockery of it.
And Troy, the Centre for Future Work obviously looks at things from the workers' perspective. Was this a good budget for workers?
In an abstract sense, you could say it was, as it has been for the last few budgets, but not in any practical sense. And like Matt, I'd like to start with a joke, a hilarious joke, about you have an economist, an engineer and a physicist on a desert island and they've got to open a can of baked beans. And the physicist works out the right way to shine the sunlight on the can to explode the can and get baked beans in his face or her face. And the engineer throws it off the rock at the right angle to open it and the economist just assumes that they have a can opener. And this is one of the fundamental issues we face repeatedly around the issue of economic forecasts, and particularly if we're looking at something like wages over the last 5 or 6 budgets, we miraculously see every single time, despite 5 years of wage stagnation since the end of the second mining boom, we see that in the second, third, fourth years of the four-year budget period, that wage growth remarkably returns to trend, to normal, healthy wages growth of 3.25 to 3.5%. And that's why our director, Jim Stanford, called our little budget briefing last night, whoops, I did it again, because Treasury still forecasts, or sorry, the government, Treasury, Department of Finance, whoever is putting this together, still forecasts that return to traditional levels that we would think of as healthy wages growth, where the reality at the moment in Australia is anything but. So that's probably the key point I'd make. And the thing that we like to emphasise is that pay increases for all workers, for millions of workers, 3.5% year-on-year cumulative pay increases, they beat tax cuts any day of the week. And those are the types of policy levers we should be leaning on in Australia at the moment if we want to have greater shared prosperity over the next 5 or 10 years than we've had over the preceding five.
So basically we've had a massive budget of tax cuts, but you're saying if you're a worker who hasn't had a pay rise in ages, a better pay rise would actually be better for you.
Absolutely right. A pay rise beats tax cuts. And the thing about the tax cuts is, as Matt was talking about, the really big flattening of the tax scale takes place in, what, 3, 4, 5 years' time, yep, down the track. This is exactly what they did last time, projecting this kind of dream of some conservatives, some on the right, of this wonderful flat tax paradise where everyone will be freed from the burden of excessive taxation. But in the short term, we're seeing modest tax cuts and nothing much to lead you to believe that we're going to get a sudden uptick in wages growth, particularly when you also look at the budget predictions and unemployment is meant to just stay at 5% for the next 4 or 5 years. So, and if lower unemployment is meant to be the main driver because of, tighter labour market conditions, of higher wages growth, how are these two things meant to intersect?
Richard, tell me about flattening our progressive tax system, because I feel like we talk about it, but maybe people don't necessarily understand the implications of that.
We're so in sync. I was about to say, Eb, let me say something about why progressive income tax is important. Back in 2004, the top tax bracket, the top tax bracket kicked in at $60,000. $60,000. Today it kicks in at $180,000. We trebled the threshold for the top tax bracket. We, on our behalf, Peter Costello, trebled the threshold for the top tax bracket. So back in the final term of the Howard government, 13% of Australians were in the top tax bracket. Today it's 3% are in the top tax bracket. Now, that not only flattens reduces the progressivity of our tax system, it changes the way that people see themselves and it changes the way that people see the income distribution. So I was watching the news last night, or the budget commentary last night, and people were talking with a straight face about middle income earners on $200,000 a year. Now, block your ears, children, but there's nothing fucking middle about earning $200,000 a year. There's nothing middle about it. It's more like three times the median wage. But because we now have a tax system where the top tax rate doesn't kick in until $180,000, we now have a whole bunch of people earning, good luck to them, $150,000, $160,000, $170,000 a year, twice median income, feeling like they're somehow in the middle. Now, Canberra is a high-income city. There's a lot of people in Canberra, by Australian standards, earn over $150,000 a year. But if you think for a minute that $200,000 a year are middle-income earners, then your perception of the income distribution has been fundamentally distorted by, in part, the way we've changed our tax system. So not only does reducing the progressivity of our tax system, such that now the government's very proud, they're saying everyone from $45,000 to $200,000 is going to be on the same tax rate. Well, that means it's not progressive. Right? Full stop. The fact that someone earning $250,000 a year pays a lot more tax than someone earning $40,000 a year doesn't make our system very progressive. But of course they do. When you earn five times more than someone, you'll probably pay a lot more tax than them. So it's not just the amount of tax, it's not just the income distribution. I think we've changed our society. We now, as a society, don't think that $200,000 a year is a lot of money. Well, it is. And to say that, for a politician to say that, has become a dangerous thing. It's absurd.
Matt, speaking of changing society, anytime I hear about climate change now, I kind of want to just go to bed and never come out. What was there in the budget for climate change?
Oh, the government and climate change, they have a difficult relationship in that they refuse to believe that the other exists. The government had $3.5 billion for a fund over 15 years. And that was really the only climate change part of the budget. But climate change was there in other ways. In some great irony, which I'm not sure that the government really noticed, they were spending $3.5 billion over 15 years. They also set up a natural disaster relief fund.
I think it's a National Party relief fund.
To, you know, basically combat the problem of climate change. They're putting $3.6 billion into it this year. So $3.5 billion to mitigate climate change over 15 years, and they're putting more than that in the first year into a fund to fight the issues around climate change that are appearing all the time. They're completely ineffective. It's not to say that $3.5 billion for programs to reduce emissions aren't a good idea, but... it's a drop in the ocean for what's actually needed. Yeah.
Eb, can I just add to that, that when it comes to the budget, we're told there's nothing more pressing. Nothing more pressing. It's a moral issue for us to not burden future generations with financial debt. Yet the same people that say that are entirely apathetic, if not hostile, to the need to protect those same generations from climate change. So... To simultaneously frame up public debt, brackets, which they doubled, as a moral issue, you know, that we owe it to future generations.
Intergenerational theft.
Oh, it's intergenerational theft. We have to be hard on the poor today, lest the poor in the future are even poorer, yet at the same time, the same government is ignoring the intergenerational distributional consequences of ignoring climate change.
Now, the other thing I want to ask about, I can't help but notice we're on the eve of an election and we've had $300 billion odd in tax cuts. Does anyone on the panel think that might be enough to turn around the electoral fortunes of the coalition?
Well, can I say that this $300 billion tax cuts, if you ignore the economics behind it, and let's face it, only the Treasurer and economists actually think the budget is about economics. It's if we strip all the economics out of it, we just look at it from a political point of view. All of the tax cuts don't come until after you guys submit your tax returns after the election. Now, this was announced a year ago. So a year ago, they knew that nobody was getting this tax cut until after the election. Now, for my mind, that is the dumbest political move you could possibly do. Nobody is feeling the benefit, no matter how small, of this tax cut until after the election. It seemed crazy to me.
I think that, the media, they love the theatre of the budget lockup. They love the theatre of budget night. And then for the last 5 years, everyone's got surprised that those 8-page wraparounds and all that wall-to-wall coverage hasn't ever actually driven the polls much at all. So you get all this analysis on budget night about what does it mean and who are they targeting and what is the strategy. And literally for 5 years, 2 weeks later, the first news poll, they're writing, well, we're surprised that it made bugger all difference. So
there's no budget bounce.
There's no budget bounce anymore. And that's because the budget has become so much about theatrics that people have become tired of these things that I think, unfortunately, people do tune out. And tuning out's not good. Mm. I'd love people to tune in, but we've got to get people to tune into the important bits. What are we spending more on? What are we spending less on? What kind of country are we trying to build? Budgets aren't about that. It's the accounting tricks and the cliches, and just doesn't seem to move the polls. So if history is anything to go by, I think this one won't move the polls either.
Troy, do you want to add anything to that?
I agree with both of those points. Obviously, I think it's been a long time since we've seen any sort of budget bounce. I mean, maybe there was a negative bounce for the Abbott and Hockey budget back in the day. Mm. But, Richard's written and talked a lot about how the right's killed neoliberalism in Australia. And so to link to Matt's point, why not just give everyone $1,000 now, before the election?
Are you running for office?
So while we're waiting for the microphones to go out into the audience here, we're, for the very first time, hopefully, streaming this live on Facebook, and I've got some questions from Facebook, so we might take one from there first. So Frederick from Queensland wants to know, what does the government need to do to make sure that wages get back on track? Perhaps you can take that one, Troy.
I don't think there's one simple thing that the government could do to get wages back on track, but there are a few different things. One, reversing the penalty rate cuts would be a start. Starting to look at those things that I know the Labor Party and the union movement have been talking about, it, but it doesn't have to be a partisan issue, but looking at the concept of a living wage instead of a minimum wage, going back to some of our own rich history, going back to the Harvester decision of 1907. What does it actually take for someone on a low income today to ensure that these people do not live in poverty, particularly when you have high levels of part-time and casual work? We had some infrastructure spending announced in this government, in this budget, $100 billion over 10 years, but it's hard to unpack exactly what that is and what it's been allocated to. But infrastructure spending is a positive, I think. One of the interesting things that I would end on, which is a little bit misleading, is there was a big emphasis, if you watched the speech last night from Treasurer Frydenberg, about skills and getting vocational education and training back on track. And if you watch just the speech, you'd come away and think, oh, that sounds pretty good, $525 million on skills. But this is where the budget papers and the politics of the budget diverge, because you don't know watching the speech whether it's $525 million over 3 days or 27 years. And when you actually go into the budget papers and look at the line item for vocational education and training, it shows that there's a real cut in vocational education and training over the next 4 years.
So not much at all then.
Eb, can I just add to that?
Yeah.
Wages didn't fall. Like, we kind of, it's like rain falls. Wages didn't fall. Wages were pushed down. It's not an accident. It's 20 years of policy. Right? The reason we deregulated the labour market, the reason that we've changed the workplace regime, was to reduce the bargaining power of unions and to lower wages. So for the budget to kind of talk about the fall in wages growth as some sort of mystery, like, we're removing all agency from this. Erica Betts, when he was employment minister in 2014, and weren't they great months, one of the first things he did was warn of a wages explosion. And he gave all these speeches to employer groups about how we had to work together to prevent the wages explosion. Well, they did.
It worked.
It worked. Mission accomplished. But if wages didn't fall, this is not some natural event that's bemusing us. It was 20 years of sustained policy that's actually reduced the bargaining power of workers. That's why wages growth are at a record low, and only policy change and cultural change will fix that.
We've got a question down here, the lady
Thank
in
you.
Purple.
Thanks very much for the presentations. Look, a question in relation to the flattening out of the progressive tax system that we've had previously. One of the mechanisms that government's been able to rely on increasing revenue has been bracket creep. And by virtue of that flattening out, doesn't that also mean that the revenue forecasts are actually probably wrong over the 10-year period, because we've now lost that mechanism? And secondly, can future governments use raising the tax-free threshold as a mechanism for reimposing some degree of equity in the tax system?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. The flatter the tax rates, the harder it is for reckless tax cuts during the mining boom, for example, income tax cuts, from being able to recover, the budget being able to recover generating revenue. It's basically taken more than 10 years to overcome those huge tax cuts, which were funded from a temporary windfall gain in the mining boom. When the mining boom went away, suddenly the deficits all appeared. And it's basically taken bracket creep over 10 years to get back. If you flatten those rates, then effectively you still have some bracket creep, but you have less because there are less people moving into higher brackets. A larger proportion of their income is in the same bracket, so you collect more revenue, but less of them go into higher brackets. So absolutely, it will slow the ability of bracket creep to make up for stupid decisions that treasurers make when they try and cut tax cuts to get re-elected.
Yeah, and on the second part of your question, we've got to be careful with the tax-free threshold. When you increase the tax-free threshold, you increase it for everybody. You increase it for low-income earners, high-income earners, and middle-income earners. And for very low, like if you're on unemployment benefits, your whole income is below the tax-free threshold. So increasing the tax-free threshold does absolutely nothing to help the lowest-income people in the country, but it actually puts about the same amount of money in the pockets of everybody, including high- and middle-income earners. So we have to be very careful with thinking that increasing the tax-free threshold is an easy solution. The low-income earners tax offset is a better way of doing it, and boy, isn't everyone excited talking about LITO.
Hi, thanks for your talks. You've spoken about how the budget represents the values of the government of the day, and we talked about this last night, and I'm just curious what you came out with as the top 3 to 5 values of this government from the budget.
You want to go first, Matt?
They like lower taxes, apparently, which means they also like lower spending. So they're interested in cutting taxes for high-income earners, and they're interested in cutting spending to low-income earners. So I think that's a value. I don't know, Richard, what other values do you reckon are in there?
They have no interest in reducing inequality. Mm. That's a value. That's a value judgment. Again, you clap when you should boo. Like, we're really going to have to work on this.
they're not interested in not just all sorts of different inequalities, gender inequality. They're not interested in reducing gender inequality.
At all, and we still don't have gender-based budget documents in the way we used to. Their value judgment is such that defence and border protection is 100 times more important than climate change. That's a value. They're both threats. Boo-hoo, there you go. We'll work it out. I think it's real. I really like democracy. I think it's so much better than the alternatives. And these guys got elected, and it's their job to allocate money according to their values. But to be clear, they did nothing last night to reduce inequality. They did nothing last night to improve the quality of public services. And they did nothing substantial last night to take on existential threats like climate change. Now, given that the economic evidence says you should solve all of those things, their willful determination not to must reflect their values and, you know, bring on the election.
Yeah, we're often reminded that Australia has a more targeted transfer payment system than many nations. And I was just wondering, how much scope is there for addressing the lack of progressivity in revenue by better targeting of the payments? Or is the scope for doing that just much less than the scope for evening things out by having a more progressive tax structure?
The most effective tool for reducing inequality that has a proven track record of actually working is the tax and transfer system. Progressive taxation and targeted transfer payments, so targeted relief for those on low incomes. There is nothing that has worked more effectively to reduce inequality than those two things. So if the government was serious, and it's a big if the government was serious about reducing inequality, then absolutely the tax and transfer system is the way you would want to do it, because that would be the way that would actually work.
And can I add to that on the transfer payments, obviously critically important, whether we're talking about New Start and the pathetic decision not to increase the rate of New Start in real terms for 25 years, and obviously the age pension, family payments and various other things. But it's also the point that Richard made about social services. That's part of why we have a progressive tax system and why we raise a particular level of taxation to provide universal access to some basic social services. So there was very little, for example, anything that would approach something slightly visionary in the budget, like something that you could also say is fairly pragmatic, like including dental, basic dental care and Medicare, right? And in order to do that, obviously, we need to increase revenue. And that's where you run up against these completely arbitrary, superficially technical sounding things like the 23.9% cap, which is really a load of rubbish, but it functions as a kind of a political block to increasing the revenues we need if we do want to fund those types of equalising types of public services.
Yeah, and just finally, the big problem, and in theory it works, and Australia historically has done it relatively well, but remember what I said before about the right-wing ratchet. When times are good, cut taxes for your friends. When times are bad, cut spending on your enemies. So every time that, you know, we've done these sort of experiments, including introducing the GST, we say, sure, it's regressive, but don't worry, I'll look after you with generous welfare payments. Oh, there's a budget deficit. Need to cut the welfare payments. So,
but they didn't cut the GST as well.
Yeah.
They didn't raise taxes back up to
or increase taxes. So the problem is the politics of cutting taxes is quite different from the politics of cutting welfare. So, you know, it's a dangerous position to put people in.
I actually have two questions. One is, you've spoken about the values of government, but how much does the budget reflect the neoliberal values and groupthink within Treasury, and whether or not that's deeply embedded there? And the second one is, what advice would you give to the Labor Party in terms of pursuing the case for better equity?
I don't think Treasury has any control over the budget anymore at all.
I agree. All the forecasts.
They're all done in the Treasurer's office, aren't they?
Certainly. So, look, it's a good question. And, you know, Australia is one of the wealthiest countries in the world. According to the pinko lefty communists at the IMF, we're one of the lowest tax countries in the world, in the developed world. Yet, you know, Treasury and other central agencies, but Treasury has a particular obsession with keeping taxes low in Australia, and I think it's because that actually makes it easy for them to win fights with spending agencies about kind of spending discipline. And this is something that we often don't talk about, and it's something that progressives perhaps should talk more about, but governments can and do waste a lot of money. Right, it's important. No, so wasting money on good ideas is a bad idea, and I don't like it at all. And I like that Treasury and finance and central agencies ask hard questions and put some pressure on spending agencies. But I think in the last couple of decades, rather than using that pressure to actually improve policy and to sort of eke every bit of benefit we can out of a dollar, I think it just became symbolic and ideological, and that was the less money we spend, the more efficient we are. And that's crazy. That's not based on economics. As you say, that's just a neoliberal assertion. And we should never forget that the wealthiest countries in the world, Sweden, Denmark, Norway, Finland, are the highest taxed countries in the world. They not only are some of the happiest, they're not only some of the wealthiest, they are certainly the highest tax. So the assertion that if we cut taxes, we make the economy more efficient and more prosperous is demonstrably untrue. But, you know, I'm yet to hear a Treasury Secretary, let alone a Treasurer, make that assertion. At a structural level, if Treasury was serious, and I don't think they are anymore, about efficient policy design, we need a revenue review committee that is as powerful as the expenditure review committee. There is no reason that the budget process shouldn't spend as much time looking for new ways to collect revenue, remove tax loopholes, remove concessions. That is just as important as finding ways to find some welfare recipients to torture.
And any advice for Labor, anyone?
Yeah, I'll give three bits of advice to Labor just for fun. Number one, probably very popular in this city, end arbitrary public sector wage caps and hiring freezes in
no,
the public sector. Public sector are good jobs, legitimate jobs. We shouldn't see them as some kind of, you know, the bludging public servant, blah, blah, blah. No, public sector jobs are good jobs, and we should have more of them. In terms of restoring the balance of power between employers and workers, let's look at opening up more multi-employer and industry-level bargaining as a way of reducing inequality in this country. And then finally, and this is probably just coming from me, but I think we should move to a much better, more universal system of childcare. So let's look at some of those models, whether it's France or the Scandinavian countries, where we don't bankrupt people and disadvantage women in particular by having exorbitant childcare costs.
Matt, do you want to add?
My only advice to Labor is don't be opposition brave and government scared. What we've heard from Labor is a lot about cutting tax loopholes, about trying to make housing more affordable, about we've heard some good things. My fear is that oppositions say these things and then don't implement them. I just hope that this time we actually see some action, because I think that if they do make Australia a fairer place, then people will respond and they're more likely to be popular, not less likely to be popular. So don't listen to the screaming interests out there. Actually follow through with what you say you're going to do.
Look, we've seen a remarkable turnaround. In 2007, when Kevin Rudd was running to be Prime Minister, he promised to take a scalpel to the public service. And when Kate Lundy said, oh, he didn't mean scalpel, he meant big cuddle, he clarified the next day and said he'd take a meat axe to the public service. 2007. So Labor and the Australian public have changed a lot in the last decade. Bill Shorten's going to this election literally promising to collect hundreds of billions of dollars in additional revenue and spending it on services. And if he keeps most of those promises, that'll be a busy first-term agenda that will change the country quite a bit. No doubt, you know, it's a good line of Matt's. It's harder to do these things than to say them. But these are popular policies that will give them the revenue they need to do popular things. Fingers crossed they stick with it.
Thanks very much. You're just talking about expenditure review and then also revenue review. I mean, the topic of foregone revenue is something that never seems to pop up at these times. I mean, I understand it's something maybe in the order of $100 billion that's lost to various subsidies and also through various tax concessions. One, why aren't these things talked about? And also, can I get some opinions about what are some of the best areas that we can look at to try and get that revenue actually flowing through?
Yeah. Thanks. It's a really important question. So the budget, the sort of the centrepiece of the budget isn't actually the Treasurer's speech. It's the appropriations bills. And the appropriations bills are at the heart of the budget, and they seek to appropriate money from consolidated revenue, from the big bank account, and says, I want to pull money out and I want to spend it on the following things. And every year, the Constitution requires the government of the day to seek appropriations to spend money on its policy objectives. Brackets, except if you introduce a tax concession. Because if Peter Costello introduces some expensive, inefficient, inequitable tax concession by putting a loophole in the Tax Act in 2006, once that concession is in the Tax Act, it stays there forever. So the tax concessions for superannuation are coming up to $40 billion a year. But you don't need to appropriate $40 billion. You don't have to go to the Parliament every year and say, can I get $40 billion in tax concessions to post to the richest people and I'll send nothing to the poorest people? Once you introduce a loophole or a concession into the Tax Act, it stays there in perpetuity. We have whole processes set up around Senate estimates to scrutinise expenditure, right? That's what the Senate estimates are. They're an examination into the appropriations. But we don't get to examine the effectiveness of the subsidies for private health insurance or the subsidies for private schools or the subsidies for superannuation, because once we exempt private schools from the GST, once we do that once, then that's just there forever. So we have this incredible scrutiny of expenditure, and we don't just need to examine how much revenue we collect, we need to annually examine which loopholes, what holes in the revenue did some idiot punch a decade ago, and is it time we fixed it up? So, yeah, but again, if you're Treasury and actually you just don't like collecting revenue, because if you collect revenue, it's harder to win a fight with the health department about why you can't spend more, then sneaking these tax concessions in and letting them grow is actually good strategy. So, yeah, we need to change structures as well as the debate.
I've got a quick question from Facebook.
Good evening. I'm Anthony Pesek. I'm the independent candidate for the Senate from the ACT. I just returned from the Smart Energy Council Forum in Sydney, which is a major industry event. And one of the things that was spoken about over and over again was the cost to every individual of climate change. And as interesting as these discussions are about tax, they pale in comparison to the cost to every individual of letting global warming go up to 2 degrees or above. Now, that was noticeably absent, any real measures regarding proper climate change approach in the budget. And from an economics point of view, putting aside any ideology, it seems nonsensical to pretty much ignore it like they have. So whilst we talk about all of the effects of tax and how much that can save different brackets, different demographics, the effects of climate change, I think they were talking about $14,000 per individual for a 2 degree rise, which isn't that far off given the trajectory that we're on. So what are your thoughts on the continuous ignorance towards climate change by the coalition?
Richard, you wrote a column on that not long ago.
Where to start? The current government claims to be small government. They claim to be trying to reduce spending. They claim to be trying to reduce the budget deficit. They claim to be free market. Yet they're determined to subsidise new coal mines. They're determined to subsidise coal-fired power stations. And they're absolutely terrified of the most simple economic instrument, a Pigovian tax, a tax on a pollution. We tax tobacco because we want to discourage it. We tax alcohol because we want to discourage its consumption. When Tony Abbott was health minister, he increased the taxes on tobacco because he wanted to discourage people smoking. When I was a kid, you used to go, remember, see how old people are here, but my dad used to take me to the dump. Remember the dump? Not the waste disposal facility, the dump. All right, and you went to the dump and you dumped stuff at the dump, except if you were me and my dad, in which you pick a few things up while you were there. In the 90s, we actually moved away from dumping to charging people to dispose of their waste. All right, because some industries were taking huge advantage of free dumps while most people kind of, you know, weren't actually abusing it. So under neoliberalism, we went to full user charging for waste disposal. And the construction industry now pays hundreds of bucks a ton to take its rubble away. For some reason, the alleged free market, the alleged small government, the alleged neoliberal conservatives in Australia are terrified of using a price on pollution.
There isn't... And that's mainly because they know that it'll work.
Yeah, they absolutely know it would work. So, and look, you know, $14,000 a year cost of climate change, I agree with you, we must act, and we must act urgently, but frankly, we should do it whether it costs $1,400 or $14 million. You know, if, and it's a big if, we really care about future generations, you do the right thing. We know that disposing of millions, hundreds of millions of tonnes of pollution into the atmosphere is causing long-run harm. We have all of the instruments available to do it. We have overwhelming public support. And the fact that we haven't done it is proof that, you know, in Australia, power is very concentrated in the hands of groups that, guess what, we've given them free coal for a century. And of course they're opposed to paying for its disposal.
And it's also still a challenge, I think, that we face collectively to tie the equality agenda that we have been talking about in relation to taxation and expenditure to the enormous challenge of tackling climate change.
Thanks very much. I've got one more question from Facebook and then I think we'll come right down here to the front. But Trevor Murray, this one might be another one for you, Troy. My dad always complains that raising wages is going to destroy his vegetable business as imports are already cheaper. How can I convince him he'll be okay and so will the rest of the country?
Well, it's a good question and comes up quite a lot, and you can respond to it in different ways in different circumstances. One of the simpler ways, I suppose, is to say that the average person having somewhat higher wages means more demand overall injected into the economy. And we have a problem in Australia, for example, with very weak retail sales and weaknesses in other sectors of the economy. So considering those on a lower income have a higher, I don't want to use too much jargon, marginal propensity to consume, they tend to spend all of their incomes, then that's one reason that you might put to your parent in a small business, say, hey, well, so-and-so down the road's going to have more money in their pocket to go to your grocers and spend a bit more of their income buying your product and help you out a bit. There's also a bunch of empirical economic literature from everyone from Kruger and Card to well-known economists to Reserve Bank research showing that higher minimum wages don't have a negative effect on employment outcomes in the aggregate.
I agree with everything Troy said. And the problem is that the way we've been told to think about the economy is as an individual and as a household or maybe as a company. But that's not the way economics works. And one of the, you know, I like economics. It was fun to learn. It's fun to teach. But listening to people talk about it bores the shit out of me. So thanks for coming. No, because really there's a lot of boring economists out there. I just hope I'm not one of them. But one of the really interesting insights in economics is something called the fallacy of composition. And economics often points out thinking fallacies for people. And the fallacy of composition simply says that what's true for an individual doesn't hold true for everyone. So if you go to work and you steal some toilet paper, you'll never have to buy toilet paper in your life and you'll save money for the rest of your life. And how good is free toilet paper? All right? It'll work. You'll get away with it because no one really cares about toilet paper. Except once you share this genius insight with everyone at your workplace, your boss will stop providing toilet paper. And this is a really
bad... Which could be suboptimal.
So the fact that something works when you do it is different from it would be a great idea if everyone did it. And it is very hard, and I forgot the questioner's name, but it is very hard to convince an individual small business person that they will be better off if they pay their workers higher wages. Because what they actually want is for everyone else to pay higher wages and for them to not pay higher wages. That's just the way they're kind of thinking. They're thinking, well, great, if everyone else, if I had a lot more customers and my costs didn't go up, how good would that be for me? But it's very hard for all the small businesses to convince every other small business to increase wages while they get to be the one that doesn't. So the fallacy of composition is a real problem in our thinking about wages because it trains us to think of wages as a cost when, as Troy said, at a macroeconomic level, wages are the main source of income and wages are the main determinant of how much we spend. So I sympathise with the questioner, and my parents ran a small business and I never succeeded in convincing them of this. But if all your customers are broke, that's crap for business. But every small business wants to be the one small business that pays low wages while all their customers get a pay rise. The simple answer is to not actually ask them.
Thanks very much, Richard. And just before we move on, I know we're on the eve of an election, but I believe we've got a former member for New England, Tony Windsor, in the audience. I'd just like to acknowledge Tony. Thanks for coming along tonight. And I believe we've got time for one last question, and I've got a keen questioner right down the front here.
Matt, you said that...
Your parents must be very proud.
You said that the Liberals put a biased set of rules for the Labor. What exactly were they?
The Liberal Party would love the Labor Party to adopt their cap on taxation. So the Liberal Party loves low taxes. The Labor Party
Not so much in recent years. And so what the Liberal Party want to do is to bind a future Labor government to make them not be able to increase taxes in order to provide the services that are very popular and the public are demanding. And what they want to do is they want to cap it at 23.9% of GDP. And it's getting close to that cap now. And but the point is that, firstly, the Liberal Party don't follow their own rules. And the reason they don't follow their own rules is because they're not compulsory. They're not set down in legislation. They can break them any time they like. And surprise, surprise, when an election is on the offing and breaking those rules you think might actually help you get re-elected, those rules vanish very quickly. But what we've got at the moment is the hypocrisy of the government out there calling on Labor to follow their rules, and they're not even willing to follow them.
And they're stupid rules.
Tell us what you really think, Richard.
So say we've decided that 23.9% of GDP is the kind of maximum amount of tax we should ever collect. Not 24, not 23.8. Look at the implied precision in 23.9. All right, leave all that aside. What that means is that, so at the moment, we've got, say we're right on 23.9. At the moment, we spend $40 billion a year on tax concessions for superannuation. It's inefficient, it's inequitable. And if I said, well, I got a better idea, how about we get rid of all the tax concessions for super and we spend exactly that same amount of money posting out a higher age pensions to people? It wouldn't have any net impact on the budget at all. But I'd have collected more revenue and I'd have spent more revenue and I'd have broken some ridiculous 23.9% threshold. So because we have this dumb threshold, we use loopholes on the revenue side to solve policy problems when it would actually be more efficient to just collect the tax as simply as possible and then hand it out to whoever we want.
And so there's another more fundamental problem. If we are on that 23.9 cap and we have a Royal Commission into aged care and we find out, well, actually, the aged care system is really, really crap, and we need to spend more money in aged care to bring it up to standard, well, we can't unless we cut something else.
Yeah.
So if the public demand something, it's popular, they want it, they expect to elect a government to give it to them, and the government turns around and goes, well, I'm sorry, that had breached the cap.
And I know we're out of time, but that is the ultimate kind of neoliberal political strategy. It is to always, it's genius. We are one of the richest countries in the world and we've been made to feel poor precisely because of arbitrary thresholds like this. So if we're at 23.9% and someone says, wow, we really have to spend a lot more on aged care and we really have to spend a lot more on disability care, what a government in Australia gets to do is, okay, so what do you want me to cut spending on? Right? And we force people to divide. We create the hungry mile of spending. Where, you know, and it does my head in. I talk to advocates for, you know, they want more money spent on health, and you speak to someone else who wants more money spent on education. I say, well, you guys have got a lot in common. Why don't you both call for more revenue and there's more money for both of you? But the way that these organisations are set up, the way that line departments are set up, is specifically designed to play all these groups off against each other so that the budget is always winners and losers, rather than, hey, good to be one of the richest countries in the world. Guess what fun we're having this year.
Does your dad always give such long answers?
That was a yes, generally, if no one else could hear that. Well, please give a round of applause for all our panellists tonight.
Thank you. Thank you.
And that's been episode 33 of Follow the Money, brought to you by the Australia Institute. It was recorded live by Clayton McDonald on the 3rd of April 2019 in Canberra with Matt Grudnoff, Richard Dennis, Troy Henderson, and as you can hear, a very croaky Ebony Bennett. You can find more analysis on the 2019 budget on the website tai.org.au or listen free to Follow the Money wherever you download your favourite podcasts. You can also listen online. Ebony will hopefully be back next episode, but even with no voice, she can still tweet at Ebony_Bennett with a double N and a double T. Matt Grudnoff is Matt Grudnoff with a double T in Matt and a double F in Grudnoff. Richard Dennis is at RDNS_TAI. Troy Henderson is at Troy C. Henderson with a C for cat. The Australia Institute is at the Oz AUS Institute. This episode was produced by me, Jennifer Macy, and Lizzie Jack. The theme music is by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum. You can find more of his music at pulseandthrum.com. Thank you for listening.